You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Today we head to the northeast of England to go on a ghostly tour of Durham in the company of the ghost whisperer, Andrew Ross. Andrew's tours take visitors to some of the most haunted locations in this historic city. There are grey ladies who scare miners on their way home from the pit, black dogs lurking in lanes, spectral music, a falling ghost, and much more. A big thank you to Andrew for joining me this week. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to my latest patron, Samantha, and thank you to each and every one of you that support me and the show each and every month. Your support is greatly appreciated. Thank you. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. And don't forget, you can get your Mysteries and Monsters t-shirts by going to mysteriesandmonsters.com and clicking the merchandise link. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. The beautiful County Durham now awaits us. But don't be fooled. Frights and scares lurk amongst the shadows. Durham is one of England's most historic and beautiful cities. Home to two saints, Cuthbert and Bede, the city has had an unusual history throughout its time in England. It's no surprise then to know its long association with the supernatural, and to discover more of this, I'm joined by Andrew Ross, the Ghost Whisperer. Andrew, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having us on your show.
You are very welcome. You are very welcome. This seems to be a theme I've got at the minute, Andrew. You are the second ghost host that I've had in recent weeks. Obviously, I had the marvellous Graham Milne from Edinburgh telling me all about some of the spooky stories from up there.
Yes, yeah.
Durham is one of England's most historic and beautiful cities with a long history of travel, and it's had a very unique history. It's one of the few places that essentially had its own laws for a very long time, along with Chester and Lancaster, I think, for quite a while. So
it's
been a special place for as long as it's been there, really, hasn't it?
It is fairly unique in England, and that, like you say, with having its own laws and with the Prince Bishops, so they were sort of more or less a law unto themselves.
Mm. So, as you've built this reputation as a ghost tour guide, and some people would say the hostest with the mostest, Andrew, in that particular region's ghost touring, how on earth did you come to the paranormal? Was it something that you've always had an interest in? Because it's a big leap from being really interested in ghosts and spirits and history and things to be taking people out several nights a week, come all weathers, which the further north you get in the UK, the harder you become. And I know, obviously, the people in the northeast are known for their tenacity and their strength in the face of all kinds of weather, Andrew.
Yeah. Well, I mean, especially with me, I work on a farm, so I'm out all weathers, so doing a walk around on a night time in most weathers, it's not too bad. But you're saying about how I got in there, I can never remember a time I hadn't had an interest in the paranormal. Over the years, I've tried to think how or why did I get into it, and I just can't find a sort of time when I wasn't interested in it.
Is it something that you were obsessed with stories, or it was because of the local history in the particular area, or that for some of us we had a first-hand contact or association with the paranormal because we ended up having or living in haunted houses, Andrew, or were you just somebody that was really fascinated by stories of ghosts?
Just really fascinated about the stories of ghosts. Anything unusual and weird, ghosts, UFOs, big cats, cryptids, anything like that, I just devoured it. I just loved it. And I love hearing other people's stories, and also I love telling people about things what have happened. I know when I was at school, I used to tell people ghost stories and stuff like that. The ones I'd been told by the family. College, went through college. Again, I should have been sort of having my book an agricultural book, but when most of the people was studying, I would have a paranormal book and just reading through that.
Well, you've done very well. Clearly, the agricultural revision was a piece of cake then, mate, if you were spending more time in the paranormal than you were in the agricultural, as you ended up working on a farm these days. So, so as you were growing up, was this something, as you said, stories that your family would tell you, were you one of those people whose family would share personal stories, or was it one of those where you'd have members of your family who just tell you stories about the numerous ghosts that are located in and around the northeast?
They would tell us numerous stories about ghosts around the northeast. I think some of it was to try and keep us away from areas, so they'd tell us a ghost story, which was the biggest mistake, because I heard a ghost story and I wanted to be there. I wanted to go and check them out. So you tell me your ghost. I mean, I can remember I would have been 10. I did one of my first investigations. I'd heard there was the report about Alan Godfrey in the paper.
Yes.
Yeah. So that 1980.
Yeah.
I would have only been, I say 10-year-old, read about this. If there's UFOs and that around there, there could be some around here. So I went, backpack, camera, binoculars, notebook, sandwiches, jam and butter sandwiches and a bottle of water. Went out to investigate. I took my nephew along with us. Not my nephew, my cousin along with us.
Yeah.
I mean, my cousin was a couple of years younger than us. And I told him what we're going to be doing. I hadn't told him that he was going to be used as bait to try and get these aliens to come along. And I would be sort of hiding back, taking photos as he's getting abducted. sadly, the aliens never came, so...
Oh, clearly they weren't tempted by your bait. You should have tried your jam sarnies on them.
That might have worked. That might have worked with jam sandwiches, yeah.
So did you go somewhere local in County Durham then? And was there a particular place that you thought, oh, this might be a really good place? Or were there stories of people seeing strange things in the sky and you thought, yeah, we'll go over there?
No, the place I went, it was just a place local, living in a little village in Durham. And we had a fields and wooded area. There was a pond called the Cop Pond, and then there was a field and marshy area. I thought it was open ground, a perfect place for something to land, and that's just where I went. So,
well, to be fair, it's the first time I've heard Alan Godfrey's case inspire people to try and use their family as bait, Andrew. But is this a theme that developed through your later years when you developed a thirst for ghost hunting, that you drag other unknowing members of your family along to act as bait for you in a variety of paranormal pursuits?
not now. I sometimes drag me long-term suffering partner along with us. I'll book a hotel and that, and we'll go. Then we'll get there and pack and stuff, and they'll say, oh, I think this is the haunted room. They'll usually ask the hotel if there's any haunted rooms, and if possible, can I have them? And she gets a bit the look. She's, you brought us along here to see ghosts, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those. It's a mutual trip. Then usually it's a treat for both of you, but for very different reasons, I suspect.
Yeah.
So I suppose as a lad growing up then, Were you someone that, as you were mentioning, family would tell you about some of the famous ghost stories in the local area and what was going on and such like? And obviously, I think anybody who's got an interest in ghosts in the UK and in England, especially in the north, will know that, the, as we were saying, northeast, be it Northumbria and Tyneside and Wearside, there are numerous locations that have a reputation. And one of the strange things I've always found about that particular area is the number of grey ladies in that particular area of the country, Andrew. So did you, when you started, did you go out to some of these famous locations? Because I think probably for anybody outside of the area, probably one of the most famous places in the northeast is Chillingham, isn't it?
It is, yeah. That's will be one of the most famous ones, like you see in the northeast, the Chillingham Castle. I used to go out to different places, but about 20 years ago, I joined a paranormal group, Twilight Worlds at South Shields. I'm still a member, and I've had the privilege of being the chairman as well for Twilight Worlds for a few years. And we go different places. We go around the northeast, but also we go further afield. Sometimes we go away for a few days to different areas in Britain, and we sort of have a few places we'll visit. I mean, the last one was we went to Wiltshire, Glastonbury, and that, and we went a few places around there just visiting sites of interest. So on weekends, when we get a chance, we will go to different places in the northeast, and then every so often just go away for the weekend.
So have you got a favourite haunted location outside of Durham? Because obviously I know we're going to dive into some of the city's famous haunted locations and stories, if that's all right with you in a bit, Andrew. So is there anywhere around the county or the rest of the northeast that you've been to more than once, or you've got a real favourite place that you thought was either really atmospheric or there was a lot going on, or it was just somewhere fabulous to go and just spend some time?
One of my favourite places is Baulam Lake up in Northumberland, just past Ponteland.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 2003, there was the apparent Bigfoot sighting around there in Baulam Lake itself. But the area around Baulam Lake, like you said about the Grey Lady, Baulam Lake itself has got a Grey Lady. But then you travel just a bit further up the road, you've got Elston, Winter's Gibbet, where William Winters, he was supposed to be put in a gibbet there after killing somebody. But his gibbet, it has a wooden head on a hook.
Mm.
And people, when they go up there, apparently they sometimes see the head moving against the wind. So it's sort of, it should be going one way with the wind blowing, but it's not, it turns around. And sometimes people see that it looks down at them, as though it's looking at them. So like I say around there, so you can go and you can sort of spend a day and to a couple of places. So stop at Baulam Lake, like I say, a nice walk. It's a real nice walk around the lake. You've got the Iron Age settlement up the top, which you can have a look at. And that, then come, they've got a nice tea room, pop in for tea, then just travel further around. Maybe also Blanchland.
All right, yeah.
Yeah, which, again, it's on the Northumberland-Durham border.
Mm.
It's a real, real nice little village. And there's a few ghosts supposed to be around there. I mean, the Lord Crewe Arms, that's well-renowned for hauntings in there. I've tried to book the room, the haunted room there, but sadly, haven't been able to get in yet, but I am hoping to one day spend the night in there. Then you come out of Blanchland into the little churchyard where the monks are supposed to be seen and that. So them two places would be probably the favourite places. It's atmospheric, but they're a nice place just to be.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one of those places. I think when you get up through North Yorkshire and you get into that part of the country, I think once people get past sort of the North Pennines and things like that, Andrew, I think the other aspect of all this beautiful county is that it's a fabulously picturesque place to live as well, because as you say, you know, you've got a wonderful coastline with some of the best beaches in England there. Probably the quickest way to wake yourself up is to go for a quick dip in the North Sea, I find.
Yes. Yeah.
As many people do over Christmas and New Year to shake off the fatigue of the holiday season. But you've also got some beautiful dales and areas where you can just go hiking, even though it's not probably one of the most popular areas. For me, I think it's easily one of the most beautiful, especially in the north.
It is. And I mean, like you say, most places you've got a real nice view. I'm lucky where I live. We're looking over to the Dales. I can turn the other way and I can sort of see the sea. And where I work, I get real nice views there. I get excellent views of Durham Cathedral, the castle, and the viaduct. So I'm getting most fields I'm working in, I'm getting a good view of the city of Durham, and it's beautiful. Yeah. And the whole of County Durham is just like the northeast up there, Northumberland. It's just a beautiful place.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's one of those places I've probably spent outside of Yorkshire. The northeast, County Durham and Tyneside is probably the area of the country I visited the most without having any family who live up there, Andrew. So
right.
I've been all around the place, and Jesmond and Hexham and Bamborough and Seaton. My partner lived on Lindisfarne for a bit, so it's a place that I know fairly well. One of my last trips recently up there was to County Durham, and we had a nice drive around the area and visited a few places. Ironically, ended up in Barnard Castle, which I wasn't aware that it had such a haunted history.
Did you get your eyes tested when you
Ironically, it wasn't long after that whole furore about all that, Andrew. We went into where, because wherever I go, I always like to dive into the local charity shop, see what gems you can uncover, and see if there's any sort of local history books kicking about and things like that. And I found a couple of brilliant books, actually, I have to say. And the lady said, oh, where are you from? We said, oh, we're from York. She said, oh, you're all right. You're near enough the same. So she said exactly the same. She said, oh, have you come to test your eyes? And I said, well, no, I'm not driving. And my partner just laughed. It seemed to be the question on everybody's lips. Trying to find Specsavers, mate.
Yeah.
So how did you gravitate from obviously working with Twilight Worlds and your interest in going to haunted locations? How long have you been doing the ghost tours in Durham then, Andrew? And how did you start? Did you approach someone, or was this something that you kind of set off on your own as a solo venture?
I just set off with a solo venture. I've only been doing it since September last year. Yep. With Twilight Worlds, like I say, we usually go out places, and what we used to do was we'd go out. Go out, and I would know stories about different places. We'd drive to the place. We did have a couple of people who were mediums. See if they picked anything up. They would sort of give us what they felt, and then I would tell the story of what was supposed to have happened there, and to see if they sort of got anything. Stuff like that. And we would drive all around, or would walk, do just a walk into it. I mean, the walk I'm doing now around Durham, in May last year, I asked family, friends, if they would want to join us. I explained what I was doing, and I just wanted feedback to see how, if it was any good, if anybody would enjoy it. And one of the group I took, like I said, was Twilight Worlds, took them around and told them the stories and that. Because I love hearing stories. But I love sharing, because I think if you don't share them, they're going to be lost.
Yeah.
And it's passing them on. And
so was Durham one of those places? I mean, Sheffield is similar, I suspect, that it seems to sometimes come across to outsiders that it shies away from its supernatural past, other than the more notable places, Andrew, where you've got every, you know, castles and manor houses and things like that. So Has there been a long history of ghost tours in Durham, or was this something that used to happen and has simply fallen by the wayside until it's been revived, or is it just one of those things that it just didn't seem to have really had enough sort of action towards producing one and doing one regularly?
When I started the walks up, I found out there was another walk. Man, David Shutton, he does a walk. He joined me on one of the walks and we went around. And he, in Durham City, he does sort of like the south side of the city, up to the prison around that way, across King's Bridge. And he also does, he takes EMF meters, the ramparts and stuff like that. He sort of makes it a walk into investigation. Myself, I go around, I tell the stories, but also point out things, little things of interest in that, or little quirky things. And with the walks, 90% of the people who've been on the walks are from County Durham. There's only 10% who are not from the region. And as we're walking around, there's tales I'm telling them which they've never heard before. There's things I'm pointing out what they've never seen before. Some of the places we were walking, they've walked all their lives and just haven't seen these things, what I'm pointing out to them. But like they say, when you're walking around, sometimes your head's just down on the floor and you're just walking.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, often it's very surprising just how much you miss if you don't look for it. And I know that might sound a bit silly, but I think you can go around most major cities and people will walk up and down streets twice a day, maybe four times a day if they're going out for their lunch, Andrew, and whether they just become blind to it because they see it every day and they don't see the remarkable. But when I think, like you say, with the fact that most of the people who come on the walks are local to the county, that they are discovering things that probably they're absolutely amazed by, because they just think, well, why have I never heard about this?
It is. I mean, like I say, with them being 90% being from Durham, and when I'm telling tales or even bits of history and that, sometimes I have heard some of the more famous ones I have heard, but a lot of the ghost stories they've never heard before. Some of the history they didn't even know about, and the stories and that, the ghost stories, if they're lost, it'll be a shame. It's a part of our history what is gone.
Well, you could consider it to be modern folklore, I would suspect, Andrew, because as you say, I think especially when you're dealing with towns and cities like Durham, same as Sheffield, they're famous for other things. You know, Durham is obviously famous for its history, and obviously as I mentioned in the introduction, its religious significance with Saints Bede and Cuthbert, and obviously all the academic reputation that it has with the university there as well. It's good to be able to preserve other aspects of the city's history, as you say, in regards to the ghost stories, because if nothing else, they tell you a lot. One of the other great aspects of this kind of thing, Andrew, is that it tells you a lot about the history of the city that, as you say, some people might never hear of, or they may hear a version of it that's more gory or been exaggerated to a point that it doesn't really bear much resemblance in it. So I suppose, as you've been developing this and learning about the history, was there anything, even with your interest in the ghosts of Durham, was there anything until you'd start doing your walk that you didn't know as much as you now do?
I would say yes. I would say a fair bit. One of the first places I start is a real nice place. It's Crook Hall. It is a gemstone. It's just out on the outskirts of Durham. It is a building. It's a manor hall, a Jacobean build, and a Georgian build. And I knew a couple little stories about it. But then, as I've learned more facts and that and more stuff about it, it's just sort of turned more and more. It's a place I really love. You know about Grey Lady, this place has got two, it's got a white lady and a grey lady.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the grey lady, she's not as nice as the white lady. The white lady is within the hall itself. The grey lady is seen in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
And time's gone past. There used to be, in fact, where Crook Hall is now, it became a slum area. And there was a pit behind Crook Hall. And the men from the houses near the Crook Hall and from Giles Gate used to go to the pit.
Mm.
Now, the ghost of this woman, she was from about the 1700s. She loved the garden. She made this garden beautiful. If you go now, you'll see more or less how the garden is, how she perfected it.
Yeah.
She hated anybody in the garden.
Mm.
Because she didn't like flowers disturbed. She just wanted to look perfect.
Yeah.
So people in the garden, you've got a chance of picking flowers. She totally hated the children in the garden. If she saw children in the garden, she would chase them. like picking flowers and that. And but like I say, I mean, apparently the kids used to sort of... We've done it in the past. It's sort of like a neighbour who maybe it's a bit... You go and sort of see how far you can get before you get chased. The kids around there used to do that as well. Go and see how far they go before they got chased. Anyway, when she died and the house sort of went bit more or less into a ruin, there was a footpath worn into the garden to get the miners to the pit behind it. Where the pitmen, they would go through during the day. But on the night time, the pitmen were terrified to come back through the garden. So they used to have a secret weapon to get into the gardens. And it was the Mars. The mothers.
Yeah.
Yeah, the mothers would go. They would take it in turns, and two of the mothers would go on. And just before the lads come out the night shift, the two women would walk through the gardens by themselves, wait for the pitmen, and then guide them through the gardens. One mother at the front, one mother at the back, so the grey lady wouldn't get them. I mean, that story, I just love, because I know how much I love my mum and that, and I know that's something she would do for me. If I sort of really sort of say, look, Mum, I don't want to go through there, will you go with us? I know she would do it. But it's sort of thinking, sort of, I'm like 6'2", and my mum's sort of about 5'3", 5'4".
Yeah.
And back then, sort of these two women just walked into the gardens by themselves to help the sons come back through. So the grey lady, it's sort of just tickle me fancy. It's just real.
Well, it's surprising how many superstitions there are when it comes to miners, Andrew.
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, we're talking about people that worked in a highly dangerous industry.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
the possibility of not coming topside after a shift was quite large for a lot of guys throughout the history, same as around Yorkshire. Northeast has a long history of coal mining. So it's amusing sometimes when you think about how tough these guys were.
Yeah.
And yet they were also extremely superstitious. So
yeah.
That doesn't surprise me in the slightest that you've got a bunch of rough and ready lads who will quite happily do 10 hours underground next to heavy machinery and then need escorting through a haunted garden by their mothers.
Yeah, true. Well, yeah. I mean, also probably the reason that they didn't have the mothers take them through the garden is like you're saying about superstitions and that. I know one of the superstitions of the pitmen was if they were going to the pits, if they saw a woman before they got the pits, they'll go back home because they thought there was going to be an accident in the pit, so they would go back home.
Mm.
Whereas if they come back from night, if they come back from the pit, well, it's okay to see a woman because they're going home.
Mm.
Yeah, so.
I'm going to say, there's probably that bit. It's probably, yeah, well, if I see a woman, I know on my way home, I'm definitely going home, because they're not going to go, oh, well, I've got to go back, do another 10 hours down to ground. Yeah. I'm not doing another shift. I mean, is it, I mean, obviously we're talking about pits and miners and the like. Is there a tradition of superstitions and legends in regards to some of the pits in your area that you've come across before, Andrew?
I know a couple of years ago, me and a girl were doing, were asked around for superstitions and that for Brom pits. And we're getting we've got the stories about the Tommy knockers, stuff like that. We've got, I was unlucky to whistle in the pit, seeing the women. We got told about seeing the women, if you saw a woman when you were coming through. But trying to find superstitions, it was real hard to get them. But, I mean, there is a lot of stories from down the pit. I mean, there was one, I forget which pit it is in the northeast, but there used to be a ghost pit pony.
Mm.
People would see a pit pony cloppering along, but there would be no pit pony there. I know my dad, one of the pits he worked in. There was two of them on work, and one of them was at the front, hewing coal, digging the coal out, filling up the tub. And there was another one near the front, and he was pulling the tub back on the rope. And they set up a system when the tub was full to shine the light, flash the light for this tub to come back. Like my dad says, he says, I'm filling the tub. He says, the tub starts going back. It's been pulled back. So he says, came back, he says, right. He says the tub was only half full, so he wouldn't get the full amount for the tub because it's only half full. Filled the second one again. He got so full, and then the tub went back. So he went down to see what the lad was doing, why he was pulling the tub back. And the lad says, well, he says, you shone your light. My dad says, well, no, I never shone light. He says, I had the light in front of us. He says, the trailer just went. So my dad says, well, look, swap around. You go to the front. He says, I'll be on the tub. I'll pull the tub back. Went. My dad says, he's watching. He saw a signal for the tub to come. So he started pulling the tub back. Sent the tub back again. A few minutes later, again, he saw the signal. Pulled the tub back. The lad came back. He says, I'm not working down there. He says, I'm not signal. He says, you'll pull the tub back. And my dad says, wait, I saw a light. And the lad says, I never shone light. Same as what happened to my dad. So, my dad said, after that, the lad he was working with would never go down the pit on a night time. He got himself, if he was on night shift, he'd make sure he sort of was up on top, above ground, because after that he was terrified of being down there by himself when he'd been in the pit on a night time, because somebody or something was signalling. Both my dad and him at separate times had seen the lights just sort of, yes, pull the tub in, but there wasn't a signal.
I mean, I think it's a bit of a shame, because we're obviously very similar in age, Andrew, so
yeah.
I think you can probably look at all parts of the United Kingdom. I suspect that there are lots of these stories that we're probably going to lose out on, because a lot of the pits have been closed for the best part of 30, 35 years now.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got a couple of wonderful collections about some stories from Yorkshire, are, some of them are absolutely chilling, some of the stories. And I remember as a young lad seeing a chap working in South Yorkshire. I'm trying to think if he was out towards Rotherham, who had had an encounter when he was doing a shift that scared him so much he refused to work underground at all. And he lost a considerable amount of money, because obviously lads who were working on the coal face and in the mine shafts would earn a lot more than anybody working at the top.
Yeah,
danger money more than anything, Andrew, I suspect.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a real shame, and I think as as you mentioned there, it's probably one of those that, unfortunately, that a lot of the people who have these stories have either passed on, or they are of a certain age that these stories probably don't have an avenue to go through, because with the greatest respect, a lot of these men will be in their sort of 60s and 70s and 80s now, who probably aren't interested in going online and following ghost pages or talking about ghosts on the internet, sadly.
True. It is. There will be a lot of people's feels what's happened to them, what will be lost, and also traditions, sort of from the pits, traditions and what they used to do. A lot of that will be gone as well, like you say, because there'll be about 60-year-old upwards.
Yeah,
the ones who work in the pits.
Yeah, because I know one of the stories I saw down here, that was there was a particular pit where they had one of the miners was renowned for not bringing his own snap tin, as they used to call it, his own dinner, Andrew.
Yeah,
and he would always steal or beg food off everybody else, and unfortunately he ended up being killed in an accident on the coal face, and this is the other strange thing. I mean, obviously, you'd have these horrendous accidents, and then they'd be back at work in the same area within a couple of weeks, wouldn't they? Because at the end of the day, they'd be losing money if they didn't get back down there, which is eye-opening when you think about it, really. And after a few weeks, some of the lads were beginning to complain that sandwiches kept being taken out of their tins, and they didn't understand what was going on. And then they began to think, is it this fella coming back? We can't see him. And he's helping himself to his sandwiches. So they then all started making extra sandwiches and just leaving them out for him.
Right.
So and apparently they stopped losing sandwiches out of their tins, because their gifts of sandwiches were gratefully accepted by this spectre. So when you were coming up with the idea of doing your ghost walk, And as you mentioned, your starting point there in regards to that brilliant story about the miners, was it a case of you had sort of a few areas that you were interested in that you thought about you wanted to go to, Andrew, or did you kind of plot a path and then look for the stories?
I had an idea, a few of the stories around the route I could take, and some of them, like Crook Hall, would start there, and like I say, there's a few ghost stories which I tell there. Walk around, I tell a couple of stories about the cathedral. Then there's one place we stop, it's on the riverside, it's near the River Walk, goes around, art installation, this pillar. It's the old steeple from off the cathedral. That was replaced in the 1990s. And the Dean and Chapter commissioned an artist to build this. And I just stopped there and I sort of just give them a quick quiz. Anybody know what this is? And I get that it's a place where the lepers used to come to worship because they wouldn't be allowed into the cathedral. Or it's a marker for a pit. I mean, it's from the 1990s. It's called The Reveal. But I stopped there because just up the road, about a mile from there, is Neville's Cross, which there was the Battle of Neville's Cross. And with that battle, there is the history. But there's three paranormal events linked to Neville's Cross and the Battle of Neville's Cross. I mean, there's one. There's a bridge what leads to Bear Park, where the road bridge goes along, but on the left-hand side of it, there is the old medieval bridge. And King David II, who was the leader of the Scottish army who came to fight at Neville's Cross, when he was getting defeated, he ran and he hid underneath that bridge. And so Neville, he sent soldiers to look for King David. Mm-hmm. One of the soldiers was resting on the bridge, saw the reflection underneath the bridge, realized somebody was underneath there, So the soldiers went either side, caught King David underneath the bridge. Now, people, when they're walking, because there's a route what takes you through Bay Park right away to Lanchester, people stop on that bridge for a tea, sandwich, just to sort of take a break. And they do what the soldier did, just rest, looking into the water of the river. And sometimes they still see reflections. And these people think there's somebody underneath there fishing. So they'll pop under, just have a chat with them, see how many fish they've caught, and get there, there's nobody there. But they swear blind that they've seen a reflection of somebody underneath the bridge. Then there's a young girl who's supposed to be seen on October the 17th, the anniversary of the battle. She's supposed to be seen wandering up along the main road through Devil's Cross. There's a bridge over there. It says that if you go on the bridge and stand on October the 17th, you see this woman walking up. She's got a baby in her arms. She's supposed to be looking for a husband because she spent the rest of her life in Durham looking for a husband who died on the battlefield but never found her. But there is the reports of her walking up along that road.
Hmm.
Yeah. And then there's Neville's Cross itself. Neville's Cross itself is a sort of a monument to the battle, which the Neville family commissioned to be built because Sir Neville, he helped win the battle, so he wanted to show how good he was. So he got this cross built, and there used to be a tale there. If you went around there 13 times and you put the A at the ground, you're supposed to hear the battle of Neville's Cross. Yeah, I mean, usually when I say tell that story, I say about going around 30 times. You have to go around anti-clockwise 13 times.
Yeah.
And I say, and put your ear to the ground and hear the Battle of Neville's Cross. I say, go around there 13 times, it's probably high blood pressure what you're hearing.
So. Well, it might be. I mean, it's one of those things, because often you'll find certain places all around the world, Andrew, where you've got to do something a specific amount of times to get a certain effect. So that to me sounds a pretty it's not the battle you can hear, it's the blood pumping in your ears. And you need to sit down probably if you've gone around there, because it's a very famous battle for anybody that follows history, because it was an attempt by the Scots to invade England, wasn't it, as well?
It was, yeah. I mean, King David, he'd been asked by King Philip of France to attack north, because King Philip was going to attack the south. He wanted to the English fighting on two quarters.
Yeah.
And his plan was, King David attacking the north, he attacks the south. It's going to split the English army.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, King David came, he did, he went to Carlisle, he got paid not to attack Carlisle. He attacked Hexham, ransacked Hexham, and then headed to Durham to attack Durham.
Mm. I do always enjoy those particular aspects of that period of time where people would turn up to ransack somewhere and they'd say, how much money do you want to go away? And they'd tell them, they'd say, right, here you are. But yeah, it's a very interesting, wasn't David supposedly shot in the face with arrows and one of them they couldn't remove or something? I remember reading once.
I've heard that he was shot in the face with arrows, but I've also heard that he was, when he was underneath the bridge, he was punched in the face with a gauntlet, which broke his jaw and that. So there is the arrows, but there is also the where you're supposed to be punched in the face with one of the knights, one of the soldiers who was wearing gauntlets. It would be similar to a knuckle duster hitting you in the face.
Oof.
Yeah, so it's pretty barbaric times it was.
Oh, not half. Not half. Yes, we're for all we complain about these days, to be fair, I'm very glad I've never suffered the misfortune of being punched in the face with a gauntlet wearing hand, I have to say, Andrew. So, are there any other notable locations that have something tied to it like that? Because I know that one of the ghosts I'm aware of, or stories of Durham that I've known about for quite a long time, is it Jimmy Allen?
Jimmy Allen, yeah. I mean, he is There is a pub in Durham. It's classed as the most haunted pub in Durham. It is not Jimmy Allen's, because the pub now is called Jimmy Allen's. It's a pub come nightclub, and it's called Jimmy Allen's. It's a real nice place. It is on Elvet Bridge, and you've got sort of two sides. You've got the top bar, and you drop down into the cellar bar. But the cellar bar, that was where, before Durham Prison was built, that was prison cells.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, people would either stay there or until they were shipped to colonies,
yeah,
or until they were hung. Jimmy Allen, he spent the rest of his life in there. I mean, Jimmy Allen, the story of that is a he was a right character.
Yes,
he was adopted by his father. His father was a gypsy. His mother couldn't look after him, so at the age of five, his father took him in to look after him.
Mm.
His father taught him how to play the Northumberland bagpipes.
Yeah,
and he became that good. He wrote music for the Northumberland bagpipes. He wrote his own music for these pipes. He was well known around Britain for his bagpipe playing.
Mm.
He became a resident bagpipe player for Alnwick Castle, and he was supposed to play for King George. It says that he played for King George at King George's wedding.
Mm.
Wait, the Alnwick Castle, the Percy family, eventually they had to sort of let Jimmy go on his way. They loved him. He was a real good bagpipe player, like I say, but his character wasn't sort of suiting for the family.
Mm.
He used to like to drink, he used to like to gamble, he was a womanizer, and they didn't think it was suitable for their name, so eventually says, look, you'll have to go after part company.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, but he went back, he went on, because he was also a sheep rustler, cattle rustler, horse rustler, horse stealer. And I mean, he also, he must have liked to take the king's money, because he joined the army four or five times.
Well, I heard that every time he got into trouble, Andrew, he just run off and join the army. Is that true?
Yeah, that's supposed to be true, yeah. If he got in trouble, he'd just go and join the army. Then he'd maybe spend 2 years in the army and then just desert. But, yeah, it was about four or five times he joined. But with the... He was eventually caught at the age of 73. He stole a horse from Gateshead.
Mm.
His plan was to ride to the borders and sell it. But somebody saw him, there must have been sort of a bit money on his head. Somebody saw him, realised they could make a bit money, so nabbed him and arrested him. He ended up back at the Assizes Court in Durham. He was found guilty and he was going to be hung. But his friend sort of says, look, he's an old man, you can't, just let him have the rest of his life. So the judge is right, he'll spend the rest of his life in prison.
Mm.
And he was to spend it in the cells, which now is part of the cellar of Jimmy Allen's, the pub.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, he died, it's a sad, he died 1810, November the 14th, he died November the 17th. A letter of pardon came from the king. Sadly, it was too late for him. He'd passed away, and so he'd missed that sort of chance of a little bit of freedom.
It's a very strange tale of a very strange life, all in all, because I think when people hear how old he was when he was finally arrested, you would think that at 73, he would have given up his rascally ways. Andrew, and for him to have the wherewithal to be stealing horses and trying to ride to Scotland on it to sell it, despite, as you say, being a very talented... Because the other thing about this is that the bagpipes that people in your area play are not the same as the bagpipes in Scotland, are they? Are they bellows that they use in the northeast?
Yeah, the yard bellow. It's sort of like you don't blow into them, it's sort of just... You're pumping them underneath your arm. You're not...
Yeah, probably better for your lung capacity, I would suggest.
Yeah.
So, in regards to Jimmy then, so what's his history after he's passed on then? What is Jimmy supposed to be doing, or what are people reporting about him in that locality?
The sound of bagpipes. People, when they're walking along Elvet Bridge, they hear bagpipes playing. It can be late at night. There's everything shut up. There's nothing... nothing open. All the nightclubs, everything's just shut down. People walking along over Elwood Bridge, hear the bagpipes playing. Another one, there was a manager, he'd left, I was hiring a car, and in fact, I'm going away this weekend to Weed Weekend in Rixton, Glasby, the Weed Weekend North. And a few years ago, I was going to the same place, and he just asked us, oh, where are you going to? And I said, and then we got on chat, and he said about, he used to manage Jimmy Allen's. Mm. And he said there was one day he was doing a bit of work, and all he could hear, he says, all he could hear was bagpipe playing. And he thought that it was the busker, because in Durham, there is a man who busks playing Northumberland bagpipes. He'll stand on Elwood Bridge, he'll stand on Framelgate Bridge, or he stands next to the marketplace in Durham, next to the indoor market. But the manager, he thought this busker was playing the bagpipes, so he just turned up the radio to drown out the noise. One of his colleagues came in, what you got the radio on for such loud for? And he said, well, he says, it's that blasted bagpipe. He says, I can't hear anything. He says, I can't concentrate.
Yeah.
And he says, well, he's gone. There's nobody there. So, oh, great. Turns the radio down. All they could hear was bagpipes. So he says, look, I'm going outside. I'm going to tell them to move on. Went outside. Nobody there. Came back into the building. All they could hear was bagpipes. And he says, both of us walked around the building trying to find out where the noise was coming from. He says, well, eventually ended up where the cells used to be. And I mean, now if you go in, they've got the cellar bar, and it is supposed to be part of the cells. But there's a passageway, which is, there's a metal gate now where you can't get up. But when he was there, he says he used to store things up there, so he says you could walk up because they weren't using the cellar. He said they weren't using the cellar as a cellar bar. So he says we walked up, and he says when we got right to the top, he says, which would be the final cell, he says, oh, we could hit. He says it was though the person was inside there playing the bagpipes. I mean, what I see for that, the tunnel of what they were in, that tunnel used to lead all the way to the marketplace, and apparently there was a one what led up to the castle as well, where the busker plays. He usually stands on the steps near the county hall in Durham, in the marketplace, and he will be standing on top of the where the tunnel is. So I see is the noise sort of travelling down the tunnel, making it sound as though it's there. But the night time, that doesn't explain the bagpipes being played on the night time, because the busker isn't there at the night time.
I do love a musical ghost. It's they're always the interesting ones, because you just think, oh, well, that's a bit like you say. That's a very plausible and rational way to look at it. That, yeah, if you hear it in the daytime, is it just acoustics and the way this fella's positioned on the surface that's causing it? But like you say, once you get to a certain time of night, that explanation just doesn't stand up anymore, does it?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
So I know, as you were saying...
Yeah, there's another... I don't want to mention the name of the other one. It is supposed to be the most haunted one. But Jimmy Allen's is the most haunted pub.
So is it in Jimmy Allen's then, is it just the bagpipes, or is there anything else strange that goes on there? And do people see anything, or do things move about, or is it just this strange musical accompaniment that people hear?
No, every so often I'm in touch with the managers to see if there's anything happening. And back in 2021, they were doing some electrical work. They were putting a new lighting system into the cellar to make the cellar area more sort of comfortable for people drinking in there. And with COVID, everything being shut down, so they thought it was the ideal time to do the work. They had an electrician in. He's doing the work. He comes upstairs and he's holding his side, can hardly breathe. He says, I felt as though I've been punched in my stomach, as though somebody's walked up prison and punched us in the stomach. And the man is, well, just sit down. He says, I'll go and make you a cup of tea. Make some cup of tea, drinking it. The electrician lifts up his T-shirt and he's got a bruise on his stomach, as though he's been punched in his stomach.
Yeah.
So he said, the electrician, because he was the gaffer, he wouldn't go back down in the cellar. So he sent two of his apprentices down to finish the job off. So you can get down there. I'm sort of paying you go down there. But they said the job took ages. Not because the apprentices weren't any good. They would be fitting something. They would have the screwdriver. They put the screwdriver on the shelf, put the wires in, get ready to tighten up the screws with the screwdriver. the screwdriver had gone. They were sick, wandering around looking for the tools, because every time they put them down, they were moved. Even like the trousers that they have, some of them have sort of pockets and that they can put the screwdrivers in.
Yeah.
Even if they put them in there, disappeared. And they would have to look around the bar to find them. So, and they said there was once electricians came in, they had a big bag, it had cables in and cable ties, the clout things to put in the wall. Says, just put them on a chair. They were having a cuppa, and this bag, it didn't fall off the chair. It flew off the chair, and it's shot about 10 foot across the bar. And I said, was there any electrical tools in? Because I thought, had one of the electrical tools start and sort of vibrated across? Says, only things in the bag was cable. And says, the weight dropped. It should have just, if something falls off a chair, that sort of weight, it should just more or less fall where it's right next to the chair.
Yeah.
Says, but this, as though somebody getting hold of it and just chucked it off the chair. Whoever it is, if it's Jimmy or another ghost, they've also got a taste for port.
Uh-huh.
They like a nice glass of port. They said, like on a nighttime, part of the thing is the barman, when they finish, they can get themselves a drink.
Yeah.
And the man who says that, a couple of barmen like a glass of port. They'll get themselves a glass of port, put it on the bar, carry on doing what they're doing, clean the trip trays, clean the optics and all that. Go back to get the drink of port, and the glass is empty. Nobody else has been in the bar except them, but the glass is empty. So Jimmy's still got a taste for his favourite tipple by the sounds of it.
Oh, marvellous, marvellous. Is there any other location on your tour, Andrew, that there is a particular favourite of yours, or you one that you tend to find people seem to be most in awe of when you're doing it? Because often there are certain stories or certain locations which seem to really excite people. So is there anything else or a favourite spot as well on the tour that you always enjoy going to, or that people tend to have more reaction to when they're there?
I would say the cathedral itself. Not only for the stories, it is a beautiful cathedral. Seeing it on a night time, it is glorious.
Hmm.
But I like the cathedral as well, because some of the stories involved around there, they are real interesting stories. I mean, there's one what I find really, it's my sort of warped sense of humour. I just find it so a funny story.
Hmm.
It was back in the 1700s. Apparently there was a man, he'd taken a bet that he could jump off the highest tower on Durham Cathedral and survive.
Right.
Yeah, so he builds a landing place where he can land, jump into, goes up the tower, jumps off, lands, survives. He gets out, he bets somebody else he can do it again. So if you've ever gone up Durham, the tower, there's a fair few steps. It takes you a fair time, 15, 20 minutes to get up to the top. Because there's that many steps.
Hmm.
200 and something, I think.
Yeah.
When he went upstairs while he's going up to the tower. His wife's downstairs, down in the cathedral grounds, and the crowd what's there, she says to the crowd, look, when my husband jumped off last time, he nearly hit his head off this side. Can we push the landing area just a bit further that way so he doesn't hit his head? She says, I'm concerned that he hits his head. On that side, she says, because if he gets it wrong, he's going to hit his head on that side. So the crowd pushes this landing place along. The fella comes, jumps off the top. This landing place, he hasn't realised his wife's moved the landing place, jumps off and misses the landing place totally. So he's killed.
Oh.
His spirit is supposed to, you're supposed to see this person falling off the tower and then getting up and then looking around. And that's the way he's looking for his wife. He's not very happy with her for moving there. But I just, like I say, I mean, I tell that story. And with me, I can't, if I'd gone up there and jumped off once and survived, I wouldn't be betting anybody else I could do it again.
You'd make sure the bet made sure you didn't need to do it again, Andrew.
Yeah.
Oh, dearie me, that's crazy.
it is.
I didn't know that when you were telling, I thought, well, there's got to be a twist here. I was expecting it to be a windy day and it might have blown it, but for his wife to be responsible for
yeah I just
Oh no!
Yeah, no. When I read it, I thought that is just it's sort of it's perfect for the Darwin Award for.
So does the cathedral have several different types of ghosts? Then obviously we've got the falling man or the jumping man or the man who didn't know when to quit.
Yeah, well, you've got the fallen man. You've got one of the bishops who's supposed to see wandering around the graveyards itself.
Mm.
Inside, I mean, there is the tale that there is a tunnel what leads all the way from Durham Cathedral to Finkel Abbey, and it's a hidden tunnel. If you can find it and get in, you've got a load of traps to face monsters, demons, and stuff like that. And right at the end, there's a wealth of gold, but it's sort of there's a dragon on the gold, and your final challenge is you have to defeat the dragon. Mm. And apparently there was somebody back in the 1820s, they tried, they went in, and they were only in 20 minutes, and they came back. They couldn't speak, and their hair had turned white because of what they'd seen in the tunnel.
Mm.
Yeah, but, I mean, with Durham Cathedral, it must be one of the most, have one of the most tunnels in Britain, because almost every major hall or manor house is supposed to have a tunnel leading from it to Durham Cathedral. There's supposed to be one to Finkel Abbey, there's supposed to be one to Usher College. There's High Butby, there's a manor house there that there's supposed to be one there. And like I say, almost every manor house is supposed to have a tunnel leading to there. So.
So, obviously, you've got your city walk, Andrew, but you're about to start, as the weather improves, we say hopefully, here in the UK, because you never know what our seasons have in store for us. You're about to start venturing out and doing some haunted wood walks. So, so what are these entailing? Are there local stories about the fae and other such creatures lurking in the local woods?
The place I'm starting from is a little village called Shincliffe. The name Shincliffe is either haunted place or demon place.
Mm.
And apparently back in, again, medieval times, there was supposed to be sort of like an imp or sort of like this goblin type thing who the farmers around, because it was part of the cathedral, but it was like their farmland where they grow crops and that.
Mm.
The cattle and that, on a night time, the cattle were supposed to be hit by flint arrows fired by this imp. And also the farmers sometimes would wake up with a creature jumping on the chest.
Mm.
And then a bit further along, you've got a wood called Nicky Knack Wood. Yeah, Nicky Knack Wood is a turra. That was supposed to be where there was a troll.
Ah.
But then also you've got around the area, there's been sightings of big cats.
Yeah.
Around that area as well. And so I'm going to link all them in. There's a bit of history, like I say, with the stories of that, of the imps and that, the Nicky Knack Wood, the Tudda, the big cats, because one of the first sightings of a big cat in the northeast, or which was investigated by PC Eddie Bell, one of the top researchers of big cats in Durham.
Yeah.
One of the first places he investigated one was a field not far from where I'm doing the walk.
Uh-huh.
And over the years, there has been sightings of these big cats. Then coming back to agricultural college, the college which I went to, there is a lot of things being seen within the college itself, where the college at one time, like I said, was run by the Dean Chapter, Durham Cathedral, and there was monks there. Some of the visions what people have seen are monk type people walking around.
Mm. Fantastic. Well, it sounds as though it's probably scarier and more dangerous for the woodwalk than it is the city walk.
Yeah, you've got your imps there. You have to dodge, and your big cats,
trolls. And
Trolls, yeah, yeah.
Oh, fabulous, fabulous. Well, the next time I'm in your neck of the woods, my friend, I shall be seeing when you're doing one of your walks and hopefully come and join you sometime, because I'll try and get up to that particular part of the UK every couple of years or so at the very latest. So if If I'm ever in your neck of the woods, my friend, I shall drop you a line.
It'll be a pleasure. Only thing I can say is make sure it's between the months of July to September.
Yeah. Don't worry. I know enough about the Northeast not to come over winter, mate. I'll tell you that much. So, Andrew, anybody who wants to know more, find your Facebook groups or book on a tour, where can they get all the information they need, my friend?
At the moment, the only thing I've got is a Facebook page called Walking with the Ghosts of Durham. Yeah, Walking with the Ghosts of Durham. Yeah, that's the only thing. I am working on a website, but with the walks and farm work, I don't get enough time to do the website there to perfect it how I want it. So if they just look on Facebook for Walking with the Ghosts of Durham.
No problems, my friend. I shall put a link in the show notes for everybody. As I can see from many a satisfied customer and wrapping up in all weathers, it doesn't seem to put them off. As I said earlier, they're very hardy souls in the Northeast, my friend. And
they are.
Come wind, rain or shine, it seems that people are still wanting to go on your tour. So I wish you the very best of luck and continued success with it, because it's clearly doing very well and people seem to be really appreciative of the work you do and your tour skills, Andrew. And I just want to say thank you so much for joining me. You take care, and hopefully we'll speak again in future, both on your tour or maybe on another episode down the line.
No, thank you very much for letting us come on the show. It has been a pleasure. I really appreciate you giving us the chance to speak.